Seated. Good morning. Case for today for this sitting is 2025-50976, United States versus James Wesley Berger. We'll hear first from Mr. Richter.
May it please the court. Thank you for taking this case seriously enough to hear it on an expedited basis during a busy week. This case started because people took James Berger seriously. Two experienced Roblox users who were familiar with the platform reported to FBI that Berger was issuing serious expressions of an intent to cause harm.
So tell us which were the most troubling statements in your view, and that you think in the whole context we're not subject to any kind of First Amendment protection. Just lay them out for us so that we'll know which ones the government is mainly relying on.
So I think the most troubling statement is probably the one charged in count two, where Berger said that he was planning to attack festival attacking bounties of Christians, that he was going to strike a grievous wound upon the followers of the cross. He named a specific date, and that lined up with a Christian music concert in Austin on that.
And his statement said something about Austin.
It doesn't say something about Austin, but it does say in a previous statement, the one in count one, which is just 4 days before, that it was going to be on their capital. That's the context we're seeing.
Okay, here. That's the main. Okay, and then the others.
And then the one in count three is the threat against law enforcement, where somebody in Roblox asks him, "What are you going to do about this?" Or "What are you going to do if they try?" And he says, and that's in response to, "Yes, I have guns in case the authorities want to arrest me. I'm ready to sacrifice my life for my robbed detonate of what I prepared munitions, and use my firearms to take many with me. Yes, wish me luck on the path of martyrdom."
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I was going to say that with respect to count one and count three, two separate experienced Roblox users reported those statements to authorities. And under this court's precedence, those sorts of reactions are probative of whether a reasonable objective observer could regard a statement.
Which precedents say that?
Daugenbaugh, Colwell, and I believe Joubert refers to that too. The decision from just this last summer where the defendant was saying, "Oh, these statements aren't true threats." And this court said, "No, these fearful reactions may not be dispositive, but they are probative of whether an objectively reasonable observer."
So you believe they could come in?
I'm sorry?
You believe they can come in to be probative for the jury to determine, or unless the court could determine that as a matter of law that no reasonable person could find these to be true threats under the law. Then you believe that these would come in to help edify the jury, unless the court could determine that.
Well, they're directly probative on the core question of whether these were true threats. So they would certainly come in. These two witnesses are prepared to testify, but the district judge...
Well, we don't often let people testify as to the core issue of the case, and when they're just, if they're not experts or something like that. And you weren't pretending to offer them as experts, were you?
No, we're not talking about them giving expert testimony, mm-hmm. but we are talking about their saying, "I understand this format, and I have been in this format, and I understand what church is, and church, the environment, in Roblox." And this case, this court has said over and over again that kind of testimony, it's not expert testimony. It's not, it goes to an element of the crime, whether it was a threat. It goes to a defense under the First Amendment. So I don't know if it's offering something that's just for the jury's edification on some ancillary point.
Now, and these two persons, one of them was a high school student at the time they heard this, and now they're an informant for the FBI. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. I don't know exactly the identity of the two people who will testify as to count one.
I thought it was
three.
The person who reported it to the National Center, which was a high school student in Nebraska.
There was a high school student who reported another statement by Mr. Berger in a different platform that also drew the FBI's attention. But I'm sorry, I don't know the details of those two people on count one.
You don't know who your witnesses are?
Well, it's not that part of it is not in the record on appeal, the exact identity of those witnesses.
I've looked through the trial record and it did the only persons it named the two people with their handles, you know, for the and one of them they had the one in that was in Nebraska and then the other one. And then there were these people in Saudi Arabia perhaps that were also participating in the discussion.
I'm not aware of anybody in Nebraska, Your Honor. The record as it exists, and it's not a trial record, of course, because we haven't been able to get to trial where these people could testify, but it was Nevada and Pennsylvania.
Nevada. I'm sorry. I said Nebraska instead of Nevada.
Right.
But that's
so
what I meant. Yes.
We have people within the United States contacting the FBI from Nevada and Pennsylvania, and then you have other users who are linked to ISIS outside the United States, and those are the ones that are saying, yes, we'll pray for you and providing encouragement to those statements.
Because they egg people on the internet all the time. Isn't that right?
That may be the case.
Isn't that just the case? You know that as a sophisticated person, as a government lawyer, that people sit on the internet and egg people on in foreign countries and agitate users in America. That's part of to disrupt our systems.
And Mr. Berger can make
that.
Mr. Berger can make that argument to a jury.
Yes. So that's why you believe it should go to a jury. Do you believe it's essential for each of these counts to be looked at separately? That you have to each count has to stand on its own at the time the statement was made, or do you not believe that that's the case?
Each count can stand on its own.
Do you believe it must stand on its own as a matter of law?
No.
What case says that you don't have to have the count stand on its own at the time the statement was made?
So when I'm saying it doesn't have to stand on its own, there are two parts of the true threat analysis. The first part is, what would an objectively reasonable observer, have believed that these were serious expressions of an intent to cause harm? And there, you can look at the counts on their own.
Should you look at the counts on their own?
You can look at the counts on their own.
You keep saying you can.
Oh, you can. You look at the counts.
What should the judge do? What is the requirement? Should you look when you're trying to decide if an objectively reasonable observer could interpret this as a true threat? Should the court or the fact finder look at each of these counts for that question, to answer that question on their own? And what does the law say on that?
So every one of these courts, I'm trying to answer the questions best I can based on these courts' cases, because these courts' cases, when they assess this question, are looking at a whole trial record. And I can see that I'm not satisfying you with my answer.
No, I'm just asking you, should you look at each count? If you're trying to decide as a matter of law if a count is viable to go to trial, you have to look at that count, right? And at the time it was made, with context of what was existed at that time, right?
Yes, you can look.
It's not meant to be a hard question.
I understand. I think the reason that we're getting wrapped up is that when you get to the second part of the true threats analysis, which is about the defendant's recklessness or intent, which is also under counterman what we have to look at. And the reason
I'm only dealing with part one. If it doesn't get over part one, we don't even get to part two. So the part one is, would a reasonable observer believe it was a threat at the time given? And in order to analyze that, should you look at the count separately from the other counts?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I can tell you that if you do look at them separately from the other counts, they still stand up.
Okay. Do you believe it's necessary to establish a specific time or place or person in order to be a true threat under the Supreme Court's authority? That's the question.
No, that this count two, for instance, does name a specific time, and it refers to a specific place when in context. And count one does the same thing. But the question is whether...
does it? Violence on Christians at their capital, which is the capital for Christians. It's not clear what the capital for Christians is. Is it? Could that be Jerusalem or Austin or Washington, D.C.? Or it doesn't have to be a secular capital, the heaven. I don't know what would be the capital for Christians in that context.
This court's cases show that threats are often not precise about an exact time.
Well, I thought you were saying that one did give a time and a place.
Well, it gives the month, and that's at least as precise as the threat this court found to be a true threat in Morales.
So wasn't there evidence of some kind of web searches about the organization that had some kind of a Christian rally or something scheduled for what turned out to be April 12th? Is that? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but explain to us what the evidence shows about those web searches and other web searches about what weapons are making bombs or whatever. Tell us. That's a multifaceted question, but tell us about that.
Sure. There are searches in Mr. Berger's devices that show that he was searching for the promoter of this concert, looking at their website before and after the dates on which he issued the threats. And then when you look and see, are there concerts in Austin on those dates, you see that there actually are. It was a concert on that specific date in Austin.
Could you look at those materials in deciding whether a reasonable observer or listener would interpret those as a true threat, things that happened after the statements were made and or things that were not in the were not privy to the listener? You understand, the question that we just had was about other searches and other things, that some of which were after the threats, the alleged threats. So could, when deciding prong one, as to a reasonable observer, would they interpret as a threat? Could you look at these things or not?
The prong one analysis is confined to what a reasonable observer would have viewed about that statement at that time. But these statements are still threats under that test. And you only have to look at the reaction of the reasonable observers to see that,
would you or would you not consider the search history of Mr. Berger in determining whether something was a true threat if the search history is after the alleged comment was made?
With respect to prong one, no. With respect to prong two, yes. And I'll also point out that when you're looking at the observer on as to count two, recall that one of the people who was seeing Berger's statements that is charged in count two was with Mr. Berger on Discord, a separate platform where Mr. Berger says, and this is not role-playing in any sense, Mr. Berger says, I've come to a conclusion about the time and place, and then that user says, let's move over to Roblox, and then they go over to Roblox, and then Mr. Berger says, I've concluded that it's gonna happen on April 12th.
Help me here. This is more foundational. We don't see this kind of case every day where an indictment has been dismissed and the government's appealing it. What is the standard by which we're assessing the grant of a dismissal of an indictment? In other words, a lot of what we're talking about, we're forecasting what may or may not come in at trial, whether the defendant testifies, whether the defendant doesn't testify, what witnesses say. We don't know any of that. So what is our standard here and now for dismissing this indictment or reviewing it?
It's whether the question that the court tried to answer was one that is committed to a jury and involves disputed facts. So under Flores, the district court should not dismiss something under Rule 12 if it involves disputed facts that go to the circumstances surrounding the crime. That's Covington. So that's why we're here now, is not to have a kind of early trial on this case, but to say we should be able to take this case to trial. And Rule 12 is careful about that, trying to do that too early, and warns against doing that too early. I also want to mention, since I just have a few seconds, that we are still asking the court to vacate the second release order. We do not believe that the second release order has been mooted in any sense.
So,
and we're also asking for
assuming for purposes of discussion that there are statements that were made that are subject to Miranda or statements that Chief Judge Elrod asked you about regarding web searches, that assuming those might not be admissible in terms of measuring the indictment or admissible at trial, they would still be admissible, though, in terms of our decision about detention orders, would they not?
I see my time's expired. May I answer?
Yes, of course.
Yes, of course. This court can look at the entire record, and the rules of evidence don't constrain what a district court or this court can look at when looking at a question of detention or release pending trial or pending appeal, for that matter.
You argue that the district court lacked jurisdiction to impose conditions after the court's December 23rd order, but you did not appeal that order, did you?
No, we did not.
So we don't have jurisdiction to look at your complaints about those conditions, do we?
You have jurisdiction to address whether the second release order is still in force, and that requires you to look at whether the third release order mooted that, and under Willis, the third release order did not move that because it is a nullity. The district court lacked jurisdiction.
Why would it be a nullity when we said that the district court could continue on ruling as new facts and things became available, and as hearings said, both in both orders that the court issued, they said that the district court retained jurisdiction to deal with detention issues under this relevant statute, both orders, both the motions panel order and the merits panel order, allow the district court to continue to look at issues about detention as they arose and as the government and the defense counsel wish to bring them up.
None of the orders said precisely that, Your Honor. What they said, and we've looked at them and tried to interpret them precisely, was the district court can proceed. The first one said the district court can proceed under 3143. The district court did not follow that procedurally. And then we did appeal from that order. And then the last order that was a clarification said that the government, in its discretion, could seek detention or...
pursuant to the statute.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and then the district court had a hearing, and the government requested relief, and the district court granted some of that relief. I mean, it seems squarely encompassed by the order we entered as the merits panel. But your position is in the issues that you raised in the 28J letter that you sent is not tantamount to a motion for any relief or anything like that with regard to this latest detention order.
No, we didn't understand this court's December 23rd order as giving the district court full sway over any kind of decision about detention or release. We're reading the letter of what this court said, which is the government in its discretion can seek detention or can seek conditions, release on conditions. And we didn't seek release on conditions. We sought detention and the district court said, no, I'm going to do release on conditions. And that's why we have said that third release order is a nullity.
Well, the government could seek something, but the district court didn't have to do what the government said. It could choose its own remedy under the statute in the panel as long as it followed due process.
And that's not what the order says.
Yeah, but it's lesser included relief, so to speak.
So,
and the government had been seeking either or all along.
So we understood that order as giving the government two alternatives and emphasizing the government's discretion to seek that. If that's not what that order means, then the district court did have the power to do what it did, but that's how we read the order, and that's our position on that order. And the important part there is that the district court takes seriously the issues that are raised by this matter.
So on the question of assignment to a different district judge, and I think we all, at least I certainly understand that it's an uncomfortable position for any attorney in here for the government to be requesting that, but we all get paid to do difficult things, so that's, anyway, I'm going to ask you about that. So tell us what are the main reasons, the main things that the district judge has done or said that you believe either justify us in or would require us to order that this matter be assigned to a different judge in the Western District?
That's exactly right. We don't make these requests willy-nilly. We have to go to the Solicitor General to seek authorization to do it, personal authorization. And the main things that we see are the pattern of events that has occurred since we filed our first appeal. If it had just been a couple of stray comments and a couple of motions hearing before that, we would not have sought reassignment. But once we filed our notice of appeal and once this court intervened on an emergency basis and said to the district court, you need to give your reasons for doing this quickly, and you need to act under Section 3143 to figure out whether there's going to be release or detention here, the district court didn't act under 3143. It decided to grant on personal recognizance, and it did so without even imposing the conditions that are required for a personal recognizance release. And then when we file another appeal
on... This was after an indictment had been dismissed, so no charges were pending against... The district court was in its prerogative to allow release with no conditions if first to someone whose indictment had been dismissed. But the district court went back and heard and gave conditions, pretty substantial conditions.
So
they had to give an order to travel things because the home detention and a monitor and all of that.
And so at the point I'm talking about, Your Honor, this court in the administrative panel had already stayed the dismissal of the indictment. So that dismissal order had been stayed. And so we're talking about what do we do with release pending the appeal. And at that point, the district court had entered conditions, we might not have any problems. We might not have any of these complications with multiple appeals. But at that point, the district court says, you're going to stay my unconditional release order? Here's another unconditional release order that is inconsistent with the statute. And then when we appeal from that order, we end up with a third hearing, which the district court expresses antipathy towards the government's case. That was supposed to be a hearing, by the way, about release or detention. And now we have comments from the district court saying this trial is going to be impossible, impugning the credibility of the government's counsel. And so,
well, weren't those in the context of the issue with the Miranda warnings, that if the court expressed frustration about the difficulty of the trial, wasn't that because of the issue with Miranda? And so that's what made the case more difficult to try.
And that underscores why it's so unusual that the district court would begin bringing this up and talking about trial. It underscores that the district court is, to use the first con factor, having trouble letting go of its previously expressed views. The parties had already resolved that this Miranda issue because the government said,
but
we don't need this
evidence.
But it would
be difficult, though, because there was a whole, 10 pages of the transcript dealing with cross-examination and what could come up. And so the court was just expressing it was a very difficult scenario to have a Miranda thrown out because of the Miranda error, which was a Miranda error. I think the government chose not to litigate that. That it was going to cause a big problem for retrial if the case had for trial if the case. So that's the context of the court being frustrated.
And when you point out, Chief Judge Elrod, that the government chose not to litigate that, that's why it's so unusual that when we're having a hearing about detention and release, the district court is going back to this issue that has been resolved by the parties. That's not going to come up because Mr. Berger has stated flatly that he's not going to testify. When those issues start getting injected back into a hearing, and those criticisms start getting injected back to a hearing about a trial that will not occur until this court remands for a trial, that's why we see the district court as fixed in his views of the case and having trouble letting go of an issue that is already before this court and already forecasting what he'll do about that issue.
Did the district judge, as I understand it, but correct me exactly what the record says because it's important, did the district judge indicate that if he were on the jury, he would acquit?
Yes, he did. At one of the motions hearing, if I were on the jury, I would acquit.
So if this goes to trial on the merits, he can listen to the government's case and then enter grant a motion for judgment of acquittal, and that would be the end of the case, right?
That's
not appealable, probably.
It would likely be unappealable, and that's why this is of such concern to the government here. We do think that if he heard our trial case, he'd have a much harder time granting a Rule 29 motion. The fact that he avoided that is part of the problem here. He should hear the case first. But yes, that is one reason the government is so concerned here, is that if we go back to a district judge who has already decided that acquittal is the right answer here, then we're going to have very limited avenues for trying to correct that problem, even if the district court misunderstands true threats, as his order evinces.
I've heard many federal judges give talks and things on this, that judges can express opinions that they don't believe witnesses and the jury is free to. When the judge has on the judge hat, it's different than someone having on the juror hat. And in fact, sometimes they let the judge give the judge's opinions about the facts in front of the jury, and sometimes, but no one's arguing that that's happening here. But did you understand that statement to be one that he was going to wear his judge hat and do something in a rule and a law? Or did you understand him to be saying if he were on the jury, he would have a juror viewpoint? And is that illegal for the judge to have a juror viewpoint, assuming that he is not sharing it with the jury?
It's not illegal, and the latter way is how we understood it at the motions hearing. But our request for reassignment, which is not something we made right after that motions hearing, we didn't rush up here and say reassign the case. It's how the case developed over really the month of December, where you have the district judge repeatedly expressing antipathy toward the government's case in a variety of contexts, where it's irrelevant to the issue before the judge at that time.
Is it relevant at all that the judge may have been irritated that the government kept trying to go to the magistrate judge rather than back to the district court? Is that some kind of subtext of what's going on?
I hesitate to opine about subtext, but I will say that our position all along has been that under Section 3142, the judicial officer that should have looked back at this when this court first, in its first administrative stay order, said, hey, you can go back under 3143. Under the operation of the statute, our position was this goes back to the judicial officer who heard it before under 3142F, I believe, or G.
Well, it didn't at all.
And it didn't
go back to that person.
It didn't go back to that person.
It went to a different magistrate judge eventually.
Right. And so at every point,
I don't know of any rule that says it must go back to the same magistrate judge and the district court doesn't maintain supervision over the magistrate judges. It can at any time take a case. But anyway, maybe we're getting far afield. Did you have a response, and do any other judge have a question? Okay. You've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. We're here today because a teenager exercised extremely poor judgment and made some disturbing comments in an online role-playing game. But the First Amendment protects speech that is disturbing, distasteful, or discomforting.
And can you give us an example? It would be hypothetical, not in the record of this case, and I'm not suggesting that it is. But can you give us an example of a statement on this particular platform in the church, whatever it's called, that would be actionable and not protected by the First Amendment? Would be considered a threat under the statute and the case law?
I think it would have to be very specific. It would have to be specific as to what the target is, so that the
give us an example. If, for example, it had made reference to a Christian music festival in April, on April 12th in Austin? Would that be substantial and sufficient?
I think if it named a specific festival in a specific city, so that, I mean, because we're in a context where players from all over the world are congregating, you know, anonymously. If it gave a specific event in a specific city on a specific date, I think that would be enough. But here,
would that be enough?
I mean, at least maybe to go to a jury. I mean, I think this is so difficult because this context is so unique.
Do we have any cases where they've ever gone to a person playing a role where anyone's been convicted of a true threat while they're playing a character?
Absolutely not. Nothing even remotely similar to this context. I mean, this is a Roblox
Across
website.
Across the country?
Okay, I have
Roblox all over the country. People right now, I think, are doing reenacting Charlie Kirk's assassination and pretending they're the killer now, and they had to take that down over the last week, I believe, because people liked, for whatever reason, which seems abhorrent, to reenact murders.
As someone that never heard of Roblox before I was assigned this case, I have been kind of horrified to, you know, see what is going on in there.
Do you have any sense of how many complaints are sent to law enforcement, FBI, any agency over any period of time from users of Roblox?
I have no idea, and that's not in the record.
I'm just wondering, are the two complaints that happened here with users who perceive this, I guess, as a threat or threatening language, is that uncommon? Is it every day of the week? It's just interesting to know. If these are the only two in the country, wouldn't that suggest that at least the recipient of the threat saw them as threatening?
So a couple things to address that, Judge Wilson. First, I don't know that there's any evidence that these are the only two. So I think that is not something that I have access to. But I want to take a step back because the government really relies on these, you know, players, you know, contacting law enforcement. And this might be stating the obvious, but every single one of these cases that brings these kind of charges starts because someone perceives a statement as a threat. But that doesn't mean that they are true threats as a matter of law. So we look at Watts, and that's a Supreme Court case where, you know, somebody at a rally says, I'm going to put LBJ in my sights. Obviously, somebody saw that statement and thought that is threatening. And the Supreme Court said, as a matter of law, no. If you look at the entire context, most of the people were laughing. That's not a true threat.
So what if somebody on Roblox says, I've been studying bomb making and I've exchanged some information with someone in Russia about how to make bombs, and I'm going to set off a bomb at this year's Super Bowl in Santa Ana, California, on February, whatever date it is. Would that be protected by First Amendment if it's on that platform?
I think it comes certainly closer to the facts here. I mean, again, this platform is so odd that we really, I mean, and
I assume you would acknowledge, or I'll ask you the question, would it be reasonable for people who have tickets to that Super Bowl to think that that was a threat and that they should feel unsafe in attending?
I think that gets closer to a jury question because we still have this strange context, but there's at least some specificity to it. So I think that does get closer to a jury question. Here, we don't have that specificity. And I think the specificity is really important because we need to look at these statements and we need to say, do they show a real possibility?
Do we look at each statement individually for the reasonable observer's view, or do we look at them in all of them together?
I think you have to look at them individually because they're charged as separate counts. There's no evidence that any particular individual saw all of these statements, you know, one after another. So I think you have to look at them individually. But going back to the specificity point, I think the specificity is so important because the true threats analysis is whether there's a reasonable chance that, you know, violence is going to follow.
Well, how far do we telescope out then? I mean, there's a continuity here. There's a time element. There are multiple platforms. There are searches on Google. There are other contacts that are made. There are the family references. The uncle took away the guns, and they put keystroke trackers on the computer. I mean, how much of that do we consider in determining the context?
None.
So we just look at this video game and we disregard everything else.
The Supreme Court in Counterman said that the true threats analysis, the existence of a true threat, depends not on the author's state of mind, but what that statement conveys to a reasonable person, what the listeners are aware of.
So it would be inappropriate for us to look at the Google searches to buttress these.
Correct.
Or to determine whether or not it's the top prong under the Supreme Court's authority. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It's a reasonable person, what they are aware of. And I want to take it back just...
So the reasonable person did not know that he had a gun or that he was doing research?
Right.
Okay.
Nobody knew that. There's no indication. And I want to take it back to these people that, you know, reached out to the FBI. That's fine. We can encourage reporting. We do. If you see something, say something. But these statements should have been the start of the investigation. Instead, they were the end. They charged the pure speech. And now this other evidence of Google searches and everything, the government's kind of trying to shoehorn an attempt case into a case about pure speech. But the government's admitted, you know, this other evidence isn't enough to be criminal. And that's really important, because when we see an attempt type case, we don't convict someone based only on their mental thoughts. We look to action. They have to take a substantial step.
But, you know, the courts have cautioned about cases that involve a mens rea situation, to taking them out in Rule 12, the idea that these dismissals sometimes are premature. And so wouldn't a jury be able to determine if this is more like a play where the person's doing research to play a character? So you look up all these jihadi things because they're playing a character of jihad, and then the other people could say, no, this is really, they really were, entranced with this, and they were going to go out and do this, and then the jury gets to decide.
Well, that isn't relevant though to the prong one, really, whether a true threat exists. Again, prong one, we're not looking at author's state of mind whatsoever. We're looking at what does a reasonable person who hears these statements think. And that, you know, Counterman is...
So prong one, you think as a matter of law, prong one stops the whole case.
Right.
And we don't even get into prong two and the recklessness and any of
right.
that.
I mean, to be clear, they have to, you know, if it were to go to trial, they have to prove recklessness. But this is a prong one test. Like, is there a true threat as a matter of law? And so I think, you know, in that context, we have to look at context and we have to look at content. And just, you know, to address the Rule 12 thing, the statements themselves are not disputed. They're alleged in the indictment. And the context isn't disputed either. This is on Roblox. It's an online gaming platform. In it, you know, the government has never disputed that the church is a toxic, you know, experience intended for debate. Roblox, you go on the website and it says immediately, be anything you can imagine. And so, you know, these are Lego-like avatars dressed as characters. And in this context, when you look at the context and then the lack of specificity from these statements, there's just no way for a reasonable juror to think that these statements are serious expressions to commit crimes in the real world.
What if someone says, well, it says it's in Austin, and we know it's in Austin?
There's no evidence of that. There's no indication that anyone knew he was in Texas. What the capital meant, like you said, that is completely ambiguous.
But it's talking about a Christian activity of some sort on April 12th, and that happened to be, you know, in Austin, where this defendant lives and where the wet festival was to occur.
So there's no indication that anyone in Roblox knew that A, Berger's avatar, where Berger lived, was Austin. There's no indication they knew about this festival. And, you know, it is kind of telling. Count 2 alleges that it's going to happen at a music festival. And so the government keeps saying there's this prominent music festival happening, and then they haven't told us until the reply brief here what is the actual festival. And it's just kind of a concert. It's not
a
music festival.
They didn't argue that to the district court, did they, about the music festival?
They kept kind of vaguely referencing, you know, there's a prominent music festival, but even what they put in their reply brief, it's just a concert that's happening in Austin, but it's not
but if we know that there's a music concert in Austin on that in April. If we know that, does that change this case?
No, because a reasonable person on Roblox doesn't know that. And the government conceded we don't have anything to link Berger to that particular festival. We don't, you know, we have no idea. We're just guessing. The government's guessing. And to go back to the attempt point, the reason we require a substantial step before you can prove, you know, an attempted crime is because we don't want to rely on speculative inferences and convict somebody based on otherwise innocent conduct.
Again, well, that's why we have juries, right? Just to sit and listen to the evidence from both sides and to determine whether a reasonable person would feel threatened.
We do, but not when a threat is not a true threat as a matter of law. That takes it out of the jury's hands. And because a fundamental right is at stake, it's so important that, you know, the district court acts as a gatekeeper here. And that's what courts in this district have done. That's what this court did in O'Dwyer. And it's really important in the First Amendment context because you have disturbing speech. You have fringe speech in this case. And you have a dispassionate district judge that can look at the speech and say, I think it's abhorrent. It was made in a cesspool. This was bad speech. But yet, I realize
you're,
that
you're calling this district judge dispassionate in this case, given the record? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, he considered the record. He thought this was a tough case.
He's obviously said that if he were on the jury, he would enter a judgment of acquittal. You know, I mean, I've been doing this job a long time. I don't ever remember. I'm not saying there's never been. But I don't ever remember dealing with a case where the record showed that a district judge in a criminal case made that kind of statement.
I mean, we cite a case in our brief where the judge opining on the strength of a case isn't, you know, that's not reassignable. That's just human nature, that a judge is going to form some opinions. And the
But saying I would render a judgment of acquittal is putting it a lot more strongly than suggesting to the government that a particular facet of its case might ultimately be weak.
I don't think that's quite what he said, Judge Smith. I think he said, if I was on the jury and based on the evidence I've heard, I would acquit. But it was also in the context of this discussion of do I take it to a jury or do I rule as a matter of law? And the fact that he said he would acquit just kind of is natural that he thought that these are not true threats as a matter of law. But this district judge was also very clear. He said, I will give the government a fair trial. I will do whatever the Fifth Circuit says. I'm ready to, you know, I'm on the sidelines. If you want to appeal, you can appeal.
I thought he sort of said, again, correct me because you know the statements, the record better than I do, but I thought he basically said, in effect, that a trial is going to be a waste of time. Something like that. Did he not?
We
don't need a trial or whatever?
No, I think he said, I'm ready to, you know, give the defendant a fair trial and do my best.
Well, he said it would be an impossible trial.
There are going to be difficulties, for sure.
Every trial has difficulties.
Absolutely.
For both sides, but that's different than impossible.
Yes, but I think he was using a little bit hyperbole. Obviously, a trial's not going to be impossible.
Well, hyperbole, but I mean, does it suggest that the judge is going to throw a wrench in the works every turn the prosecution tries to take so the judge can't be fair?
Absolutely not. I mean, and this is all of the government's making. You know, the government is the one that didn't.
Once the district court said, well, I would acquit if I were a juror, ultimately, he is sort of the 13th juror because he can dismiss the indictment at the end of trial, hearing the evidence, et cetera. But then he also said this is going to be an impossible trial. Is the judge, if we send this back, going to be able to suspend all of that and then make sure the trial is fair for both sides and et cetera?
Absolutely. I think this is a case...
As opposed to being a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, that's human nature also.
This judge has shown his ability to reconsider his views like he did on release. Initially, it was without conditions, and then came back, had a huge hearing. And he said, all right, I'm going to impose strict conditions. He's flexible.
He's maybe flexible with a little help from this court. I mean, we said some things in our successive orders about the detention issue that maybe suggested that either the defendant could be detained or the government could come back and seek relief of detention. And they did. And then, yes, the district court reconsidered. But, I mean, how much does that tell us?
I think it shows that he's willing to reconsider his views and, you know, come back. And I think these are just two things that the government has cherry-picked off of a big record showing him carefully considering this case, saying he's going to give a fair trial, and saying that he's going to, you know, do whatever this court tells him to do. So I think in the entire record, we can't assume the worst in this district judge. And none of these little things, you know, if, look, I, you know, I'm a defense lawyer. We lose a lot. But we don't move to reassign in every case, even when there's some, you know, stuff that's not so savory. And this is just, there's no basis here to reassign this case to a different judge. I guess just briefly on the release issue, I think it's moot. They haven't appealed the other order. Regardless, he's going to be on release with strict conditions, and he's doing well on release with strict conditions, so that there's just nothing to decide there on this court.
So
for this
I want to understand. I'm not arguing with what you said, but I want to be sure that I've got it straight. Are you saying that we're not, as things stand today, we're not empowered to ourselves to impose a condition of total confinement?
Right. That issue is not before this court. The issue before this court that the government appealed is whether the district court erred by releasing Berger unconditionally, whether that was an abuse of discretion. The government has not appealed the district court's order saying that he will be released on strict conditions that the government asked for.
So the one that they did appeal is now moot because there's a new one and they haven't appealed the new one.
That's 100% correct. So if there are no further questions, we would ask this court to affirm the district court's order.
Again, I don't mean to interrupt you. You're doing a good job. But if we were to order the reinstatement of the indictment, would it still go back then to the district judge, either this one or a new one, to decide conditions of confinement, or would we be able to order conditions of confinement or order that there be no special conditions?
So technically the indictment is in effect right now because that order is stayed. I am not aware of any authority that would allow this court to say he must be confined, because that issue just is not before this court. The government hasn't argued that, you know, the district court erred by not confining him. They argued that the district court erred by not releasing him unconditionally. So it will regardless go back for a, you know, right now the order is that he's released on strict conditions. So, and that order hasn't been appealed. So that is in effect right now for the indefinite future until something else happens in the district court.
Under an indictment that's still in effect, as you just explained.
Right, right. And the district court said, you know, given everything that's happened, you know, in the months since he was arrested, you know, I'm going to let him out even if it comes back on these strict conditions, home detention, ankle monitoring.
So if something happened, I'm not foreshadowing, but if the case went back, it was unstayed, the indictment was not dismissed, and something happened that he wasn't, you know, staying where he's supposed to stay or going to his therapy or whatever, then the government could move for the district court to change the conditions to be more strenuous if it was not.
Of course, or they could move for detention.
Just like on anyone else who's on home detention that's indicted.
Of course, or the government, if he violates his conditions, they could move for detention. That's a changed circumstance. But right now, as it stands, he's out on strict conditions and he's doing well. And that order isn't before this court right now. You have to file a notice of appeal to get an order before the court. We would ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Once you concede that a statement in Roblox can be a true threat, then it becomes a question for a jury whether, looking at the context of the statement and the statement itself, that was a threat.
Can a statement in Roblox be a true threat? Has there ever been anyone playing a game with an avatar making a statement that has been convicted in all of America under making a threat? Has that ever happened? Is this sui generis?
I don't think it's sui generis, Your Honor. I don't have a case showing somebody playing a game, but the point is that the factual dispute and the reason that this should not have been resolved under Rule 12 is, was Berger playing a game? And did people understand him as playing a game? Because not everybody understood him as playing
a game. Wasn't he playing the game for sure?
No.
He's playing Roblox, the game in the church room. I mean,
that is subject to dispute. And I'm going to go back to the statement in count two, where he is on a different platform, which is not a game, and says, I've decided when and where this is going to happen. And then that person says, let's move over to Roblox. And by the way, we've also pointed
out. But is that statement on the other platform at issue in counts one or two?
In count two.
Okay.
Yes. That is the setup for count two. And
that's not count two. Count two statement is the Roblox statement.
Right. He doesn't make the threat in the other platform. He says in the other platform, now I know where I'm going to take out, do this attack.
And there was a suggestion in the other platform that if you want to get First Amendment protection, you want to move to a different platform, right?
The suggestions that we have are that moving to Roblox is a way to avoid the attention of authorities. So by saying, I'm going to be in Roblox, that's a way to create a zone where I can collaborate with co-conspirators, issue threats, all kinds of things, and then laugh it off later and say, it was just a game. I was just playing a role. But that is a question for a jury. Once you see that there is a dispute, and there is a dispute here as to what was happening in Roblox, not only how Berger understood it, but how the people around him understood it, because of that dispute, that becomes a question for a jury under Rule 12. That under Rule 12, going all the way back to this court's decision in Mann, a district court is not supposed to resolve factual disputes that go to the general issue at stake.
So, but I just want to make sure, do we or do we not have any case where an avatar has made statements in a game and there was a true threat case brought? No such case?
I don't have any case like that, and it doesn't matter because there are, as we pointed out in the reply brief, there are many situations in which new media are used to issue threats. And for instance, in Perez, where you have a Facebook post, you have emojis, cry laughing, and that defendant came to you and said, oh, it was just a joke. See, this is Facebook, I'm commenting. And this court said, no, a jury could and did reasonably view this.
But that wasn't a character, right? That was a person on their own Facebook?
That wasn't a character, but people can use Facebook.
This is like a play or something. Couldn't it be? I guess that could be argued to the jury.
That is a question for the jury. Mr. Berger can go to the jury and he can say, okay, I was just being a character.
Would we create a circuit split were we to rule that this should go to a jury because of the Second Circuit's opinion?
No, I believe that actually ruling for Mr. Berger here would create the circuit splits. The circuits
are. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Sure. So the circuits have been aligned that Rule 12 is not a vehicle for district courts to resolve incomplete and disputed records. That's Rodriguez-Rivera from the First Circuit. You mentioned the Second Circuit. The Wed decision that we cite in our briefs says that Rule 12 is not a mechanism to say to the government, give us all your evidence or we're going to dismiss your case. Sholay Gonzalez from the Eighth Circuit, Justice Gorsuch's or then Judge Gorsuch's decision in Pope from the Tenth Circuit, all of those circuits are aligned in saying that Rule 12 is not a mechanism to do what the district court did here. And so I don't know of any circuit that we would get out of line with if this court were to reverse and say there are factual disputes here about exactly what was occurring, how a reasonable observer would have understood what was occurring. That is a question for the jury. We're not asking this court to enter a judgment of conviction. We're just asking for a chance to prove this to a jury. And that's where the district court went wrong here. The district court assumed that this had to be a game, that he was just playing a game, and that everybody understood it that way.
At the end of the discussion with Mr. Innings, he talked about, and you talked about too earlier, about our jurisdiction over conditions of confinement. I don't mean to be repetitious, but I want to be sure I know what the government's position is on our authority today, whether we do have or don't have authority today to impose, either to impose different conditions of confinement or to direct either this district judge or a replacement district judge to impose conditions of confinement, or is that something that we are without jurisdiction to do given the posture of the case?
What this court can do today is rule that the third release order was issued without jurisdiction and that it is therefore nullity, and that you are reviewing the second release order, which is the release, unconditional release order on personal recognizance, ruled that that was an abuse of discretion, as the administrative panel has already suggested, and then remand, preferably to a new district judge, for that district judge to enter either a detention order or an order of release on conditions.
Okay, I'm trying to understand further. So if the third order was not appealed, how do we have jurisdiction to say whether or not the district court had jurisdiction under the third order? Does that come back to the one court principle or what? I'm just trying to understand that. I'm not quarreling with you or Mr. Hennings about that, but we need to have it straight.
Sure, and I appreciate the opportunity. Under Willis and Griggs, only one court at a time can be addressing the question of release or detention. The government's appeal from the second release order put that issue before this court.
And took the jurisdiction away from the district judge, is that what you
mean? And took jurisdiction away from the district judge. This court gave the district judge a very confined task, saying that the government, in its discretion, could seek detention. We sought detention. The district judge ignored that and said, no, I'm going to do something different.
Well, first, before we did that, though, we said the district court could continue to look at. We specifically gave the baton back to the district court in the motions panel order, didn't we?
Yes, you did. That was a prior order, and then when the district court took that baton, he used his discretion.
So it wasn't the one court position, because we gave the baton back to the district court on purpose and said, you're free to continue to rule in this area if you wish.
And then he took the baton, he exercised his discretion, abused it. We appealed that order, so that's the second appeal notice, and that's the notice that put the release or detention question back in this court's field.
So you would say we would go back to that time where this young man has no conditions on him and we would be in that world?
No.
And then we would have to rule that world is wrong, because that's not that's moot, because there actually are conditions on him here today.
No, the first release order has been stayed and is no longer in effect because of this court's stay. The second release order has been stayed, and the third release order is a nullity. So what is in effect is the detention order from May. Right now, Mr. Berger should be detained. No. So you could, to answer Judge Smith's question, say there is a nullity. We have two stayed release orders. Right now, you're under detention order. And at that point, you could pass the baton back to the district court.
The baton back to the district court and said the district court can do anything it wants within the law, based upon requests which you were allowed to bring.
Are you talking about in the third release order?
Both the motions panel and our merits panel allowed the district court to continue to rule in this area.
So with respect to the motions panel, we appealed that order once the district court exercised discretion, bringing it back to this court. And with respect to the merits panel and that order, we still understand that order to have given the discretion to the government to seek detention and not to the district court to do whatever it felt like.
Or home confinement.
Right. We could have sought some sort of release on conditions, but we didn't. And that's not how the order reads.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. I think we have your argument, unless someone else has something further. In which case, this case is submitted. We appreciate the arguments of counsel. And this concludes this session of the court.